Thanks so much for coming to my talk, and thanks to Colin and Bob for putting this symposium together. At the outset, I should make sure that I thank my partners in crime, because I very rarely actually have time to get to my final slide. A lot of the behavioral work and behavioral data collection was done by two postdocs in my lab, Ellen Van Wilgenberg and Miriam Brandt, and the chemical syntheses that I'll talk about were done in Ken Shea's lab at University of California, Irvine. And this work was supported by the USDA and the California Structural Pest Control Board. So today I'm going to talk to you about some work we've been doing recently on nest mate recognition and the chemical ecology of nest mate recognition in this beast here, the invasive Argentine ant. If you're walking around the town and country here while you're at the meeting and you happen to notice an ant on the ground, this is almost certainly the species you're seeing. Argentine ants are native to South America. They occur in northern Argentina, southern Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay. And they've been introduced to pretty much every Mediterranean-type climate in the world. So they occur here throughout coastal California and in a lot of agricultural areas in the Central Valley. They're in the southeastern United States, the true Mediterranean, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Hawaii, all over the place. And in their introduced range, they cause a variety of problems. First, they're an agricultural pest, not so much in terms of the damage they do directly to crops, but indirectly by sending plant pests such as these scale insects shown here, or things like aphids. And so when Argentine ants invade an agricultural area, they protect these aphids and scale insects from potential parasitoids or predators, and in return they get a sweet secretion produced by the aphids and scale insects called honeydew. And so effectively what this means is the population densities of these plant pests really booms in the presence of Argentine ants, and so in turn does the damage that they do to the plants. Second, Argentine ants are a huge problem in businesses and households throughout their introduced range. Here in California, they surpass both fleas and cockroaches to be the number one household pest that exterminators are called upon to remove from people's houses, which is really expensive, and it's also ecologically damaging because the general method of controlling Argentine ants in residences and businesses is using sort of general insecticides, which not only target Argentine ants, but hit other non-target organisms as well. And finally, and perhaps most disturbingly, Argentine ants are an ecological problem. When Argentine ants invade an ecosystem in their introduced range, they displace virtually all species of native ants. In many cases, places like the coastal sage scrub habitat that you see around here should have between 15 or 20 native species of ants. But when Argentine ants come in, they reduce that ant community down to just one species, the Argentine ant, or maybe one other species that's occasionally found. And this is bad not only for ants, but it's bad for other things that occur in those habitats as well. There are native plants that depend on native ants for seed dispersal. There are things that eat native ants. And so this loss of the native ant community can have reverberations that sort of work their way throughout the ecosystem. And so shown here is one of the native ant species that Argentine ants displace here in Southern California, Tamponotus dumatorum. And of course, one of the neat things that I really love about this slide is it has an Argentine ant here in the foreground, which you can hardly see because it's dwarfed by this native species that it displaces. In fact, this is one of the most sensitive native species to Argentine ant invasions. It's one of the first to disappear. And this, you know, size asymmetry between this invader and a species that it eradicates is really striking. It makes you wonder, how is it that these kind of small and, you know, wimpy-looking Argentine ants can exert such a profound influence on these individually much larger and more robust native species? And the answer lies in Argentine ant's unusual colony structure that occurs in the introduced range. So when we think of an ant colony, we typically think of something like this. We have a colony that exists within a spatially restricted area, and it may be comprised of a single nest, or in this example, two nests. And then that colony defends its spatial territory against other colonies of the same species, shown here by these other circles. And so you have, in most native species here in California, they occur sort of as a patchwork of territorial, intraspecifically aggressive nests. And that intraspecific aggression keeps their populations somewhat in check. In contrast, Argentine ants in their introduced range have a colony structure known as unicoloniality. And so they may have a similar number of nests distributed across a certain amount of space as you see in multicolonial ant species, but there are no territory boundaries. Instead, Argentine ants and other unicolonial species form these sort of fluid networks of nests that can fuse and fission and even move throughout space on an hourly or daily basis. So for example, you'll see Argentine ants will move under rocks in the sun to heat up their brood in the mornings, and then move away as the sprinklers come on to escape the water. And so they're very fluid, and they fuse and fission, and are very dynamic through space and time. But also, because they've eliminated a lot of these costs associated with intraspecific aggression and territoriality, they're not bearing these burdens of mortality that are associated with this aggression. And so as a result, their population densities can reach incredibly high levels in the introduced range. They can really dominate food resources and nesting resources. And they can exclude native ant species, which are multicolonial, just by sheer numerical superiority. And so in introduced populations of Argentinians, this neocolonial colony structure translates into extremely large population sizes. And here are some examples from some previous work that we've done that I'm not going to talk about too much, just sort of demonstrating what this looks like in the real world. These are data that are collected from 7 sites in the introduced range. On the x-axis, we have distance in meters between sites that we're testing. On the y-axis, we have a level of intraspecific aggression as determined by using a very similar behavioral assay to what Bob was talking about. And so, for example, here in Temecula, or let's pick something closer to here, La Jolla, just a few miles up the road, you can pick up Argentine ants at one site, walk 1,000 meters away, pair them with Argentine ants from the second site, and typically you'll see very little or no aggression whatsoever. So this aggression score of 1 is antenation, where they're just sniffing each other, but there's no overt aggression whatsoever. A 2 is very low aggression. It's actually an avoid, where they just repel each other. And so what you have at a local spatial scale, on order of hundreds or sometimes thousands of meters, are Argentine ants forming these large super colonies, and you're not seeing any colony boundaries. This is this unicoloniality that I was talking about. There's one exception here, and I'm not going to talk about it too much, but it's very clear that on at least a couple occasions, there have been secondary introductions of genetically different Argentine ants that are spatially localized and aggressive towards each other, as well as towards this large super colony that dominates virtually all of California. In the native range, we see something very, very different. These are data collected in northern Argentina at 8 different sites. And again, on the x-axis, we have distance in meters between sites that we're comparing. On the y-axis, we have the same aggression score. And you can see that the colony structure is very, very different. For example, here in Alvear, you pick up Argentine ants, you walk 300 meters away, you pair them with Argentine ants from the second site, and you see very high levels of aggression, indicating that somewhere along those 300 meters, you've walked across the colony boundary, and now you're pairing ants from different colonies against each other, and they're attacking each other. And in fact, in the native range, if you sort of look in 2 dimensions across space, you see that Argentine ants form this patchwork of colonies that are aggressive towards each other, much like I was describing for most multicolonial species. And so the colony structure is very, very different between the native and introduced ranges. Here's a similar type of figure. On the x-axis, we have distance, again, between sites we're comparing. On the y-axis, again, we have mean aggression score. But now these distances are in terms of kilometers. So these are data that are collected not within a study site that we can, you know, walk the distance of, you know, the size of a football field, but instead these are data collected across the entire state of California, from San Diego up to north of San Francisco, or in the native range from Buenos Aires all the way up to far northern Argentina, the border with Paraguay. And what you can see here is a pattern that reflects what you see at the local spatial scales. Argentinians are forming this single massive super colony in the introduced range. And this is some of the worst field work that we've ever conducted because, you know, we spent a week driving up the coast of California pairing Argentine ants against each other and never saw anything other than ants walking around sniffing each other in the vials. So thousands and thousands of behavioral assays and not a single incident of aggression whatsoever. In the native range, you see something that mirrors what you see at a local spatial scale. Whenever you're pairing ants that are more than 100 kilometers apart, you've always crossed many colony boundaries and they're very aggressive towards each other. Okay, and so we've done a lot of population genetic work and other behavioral ecology work, both in the lab and in the field, that have allowed us to put together sort of a working hypothesis for why there's this difference in colony structure between native and introduced ranges. And if anybody would like to talk about this in more detail, I'd love to get into some of the more detailed genetic work that we've done in the past. But here's sort of our working hypothesis for how Argentinians have become unicolonial in an introduced range. We have high levels of genetic diversity in native populations, and colonies are very genetically differentiated from one another across space. And so between colonies, there are large genetic differences that can be used to accurately identify who's a member of your colony and who's not. And so you have, as you see for most other ant species, these relatively small colonies that are multicolonial and form essentially family groups. But then during their introduction to the United States and other parts of their introduced range, they've gone through a genetic bottleneck, lost huge amounts of genetic diversity. Actually, one of the largest losses of genetic diversity that's been recorded for any organism anywhere. And they've come out on the other side very genetically homogeneous. And if they're still using these recognition rules that evolved in the native range, where they're looking for genetic differences to identify non-nest mates, those genetic signals just aren't there in the introduced range. And so they treat everybody as a nest mate. An Argentine goes out into the world here in California, encounters other Argentines pretty much anywhere, and chances are they're very genetically similar to each other, and they say, well, you smell like a relative, you must be a nestmate, and so I'm going to be friendly towards you. But we know that there are exceptions to this rule. The native range is one big exception, and as I mentioned before, there are these small little, what we call secondary colonies, that are probably the products of secondary introductions from the native range, from somewhere else in the introduced range. And ants, when you pair them between these secondary colonies and a large super colony, you can see high levels of regression, and you see the same thing in the native range. So clearly, Argentine ants are still capable of displaying intraspecific aggression when sufficient genetic differences occur. And so recently we've become more interested in what the actual mechanisms are that Argentines use to recognize and distinguish nestmates from non-nestmates. And this is sort of very similar to what Bob was just talking about. He set me up very well by presenting some of my background information for me. But sort of the central dogma for how many social insect recognition systems work are that individuals carry on their body some sort of phenotypic label. And in many cases, this is believed to be particular hydrocarbons. And so here I've shown these two different ants that have two different phenotypic labels on their bodies. One just I've called A and one I've called E. And these individuals also have to have a template. They have to have some sort of idea of which phenotypic labels on other individuals they'll accept as self or nestmates. And so in this case, you have this ant is looking for others with the same label as it, A's, but then also maybe B's, it'll accept as nestmates as well. This individual here is looking for E's or F's. And when a mismatch occurs, as in this example here, when an encountered individual's labels don't match the template of the acting individual, then there's what's called a phenotype label mismatch, and often aggression occurs. It's believed that these templates, in many cases, form by imprinting on the social group that this particular target individual was reared in. And so in ants, people have done these really neat cross-fostering experiments where you can rear ant pupa in a foreign colony. They emerge as young ants. The imprints on the odors of the wrong colony, and that becomes what their template is, and they will accept individuals possessing this wrong template for the rest of their lives. Okay, and so I'm going to talk for the rest of my talk mainly about the label side of this nestmate recognition process. I'm going to talk a little bit at the very end about template formation. But in the past year or two, we've become very interested in identifying what are the specific chemicals that are used as nestmate recognition labels. In a previous study, we did a huge correlative analysis across the state of California, collecting Argentine ants from sites both within this huge super colony, shown by all these red circles here, as well as from the secondary colonies, shown by these non-red circles here. And so we've compared, in this case, individual workers, hydrocarbon profiles of individual workers that were collected from 30 different nests belonging to either the same super colony or different super colonies. And we went through and did simply correlative analysis for each one of these chemicals, looking for ones that correlated with aggressive behavior. That is, which of these chemicals are most different between ants that are aggressive towards each other, and at the same time, at similar concentrations on ants that accept each other as nestmates, trying to identify likely candidates for the cues that Argentine ants are honing in on as nestmate recognition cues. As you remember from Bob's talk, cuticular hydrocarbons are multifunctional compounds. They probably evolved for desiccation resistance or to prevent microbial infection. And so in these hydrocarbon profiles, virtually all of these chemicals are probably have nothing to do with nestmate recognition whatsoever. And so we're trying to pull the needles out of these haystacks to figure out which are the ones that the ants are smelling that trigger aggression when it occurs. You also notice that these Argentine ant hydrocarbon profiles, compared to many other species of ants, including Solanops invicta, are very complicated. They have well over 100 compounds, and probably many, many more than the ones that we can see here that just occur at trace concentrations. For those of you who aren't used to looking at these types of things, this is just a hydrocarbon profile run out on a GC, where on the x-axis we have the retention time on a column as it's running through. On the y-axis we have a detector response, which is just a measure of the concentration, and each of the chemicals presumably comes off at a slightly different time, and the height of each peak for each compound indicates its relative abundance in the profile. And so what we end up with is this huge spreadsheet. I expect you all to remember all these numbers because they'll become important later on. Now you come up with this huge spreadsheet, which goes on that way for probably 25 more feet, where each individual compound is a column, each nest that we've sampled from is a row, and then we have nests that occur within the same colony, and then we have different colonies. And so you can go through And you can just, you know, look at the distribution of variants or however you choose to analyze these things and look for compounds that are most different among colonies that display aggression towards each other but similar within colonies, regardless of geographic distance, similar between individuals that accept each other as nestmates. And so then you come out with a ranked list of some that stand out as good candidates for those that are used for nestmate recognition. And so here's our short list of things that we think are probably used for nestmate recognition. They're all straight chain alkanes, no double bonds, of about 33 to 39 carbons long, with one, two, or three methyl groups that poke off in various orientations. All right, so this is all fine and good. We've done this big correlative analysis. We have candidates that we think are used for nestmate recognition. We don't actually know anything about this for sure. What we'd like to know is, you know, can we test these compounds individually and somehow manipulate the hydrocarbon profiles of individual ants and see if we get an appropriate behavioral response? And so we've recently started a collaboration with a chemistry lab at UC Irvine who's been able to synthesize some of these hydrocarbons for us in pure form. So the ones that we have now are these shown in these green boxes, as well as this dimethyl that we've recently got now. He's been able to synthesize each of these hydrocarbons for us in pure form, and we can now take these hydrocarbons one by one or in combination, put them on the exoskeletons of individual ants, put them back in nestmate in behavioral assays with their nestmates, and ask, is changing this one particular hydrocarbon sufficient to cause rejection of this individual ant as a non-nestmate? And so we can go through and actually functionally screen these candidate compounds for their ability to alter the recognition, the ability of ants to recognize true nestmates as nestmates. So these are some of our preliminary data that we've collected. We probably have behavioral assays going on in my lab now as we speak. These are just for the first single methyl hydrocarbons, which are the ones that we started with because the chemical synthesis was easiest for these. And we've tested these hydrocarbons. We've also done some trimethyls now as well. On five different colonies. This one, LP, is the large super colony that dominates virtually all of California. And then we have four of these smaller little secondary colonies. On the y-axis, we have mean aggression score, as we've seen before, but now on the x-axis, we have categories of controls or treatments. The white bars are controls, negative controls, where ants are treated with hydrocarbon extracts from nestmates and none of our synthetic hydrocarbons to see if just altering the overall concentration of hydrocarbons on individual ants somehow triggers rejection as non-nestmates. And we see that in all cases, we have no aggression displayed towards these negative controls. As a second negative control, we've used a linear C36. So a 36 carbon chain with no methyl groups that you can buy from chemistry supply houses, and it's not present in the hydrocarbon profiles of Argentinians naturally. And we see in all cases, we see no significant increase in aggression towards this negative control, even in these couple of cases, where we used a huge amount of it, five times the concentration that we see most hydrocarbons occurring at in the profile. So even adding this extra linear hydrocarbon to the profile at a high concentration doesn't cause these individual workers to be rejected as non-nestmates. Okay, so that's nice, that's comforting. The gray bars and the black bars are now treatments. The black bars show treatments of individual ants with mixtures of these different synthetic hydrocarbons. Sounds like we're about to lift off here. And the gray bars show treatments of individual ants with individual hydrocarbons using two different ones so far. And we've repeated this for many other hydrocarbons, and the basic pattern we see is the same. So first, if we treat Argentine ant workers with all five of these hydrocarbons at concentrations that that match the naturally occurring concentrations on Argentinians, we see that in every case, there's a significant increase in aggression towards these individuals. I should say that we haven't done the full statistical analyses for this yet. We're waiting until we get all the data from all the individual hydrocarbons so we can control the amount of corrections we have to do. But in this case, we have done the statistical test, and it's true in every one of these cases, there's a significant increase in aggression towards these treated with a mixture of five hydrocarbons. We see sort of a mixed bag if we look at the other things, though. In some cases, we see mixtures of just the C35s or just the C37s don't seem to increase levels of intraspecific aggression towards treated ants, whereas in other cases, we see something that looks like it's probably going to be significant. And a similar pattern for the single hydrocarbon. In some cases, we see not much going on. In other cases, we see patterns that look like there are higher levels of aggression displayed towards individuals treated with a single hydrocarbon. And so this sort of mixed bag, this variation in behavioral response from hydrocarbon to hydrocarbon, is exactly what we'd expect to see if we were on the right path, if these were truly chemicals that are used for nest mate recognition. That's because, you know, out in nature, the way that Argentine ants are detecting who's a nest mate and who's not is because there's natural variation in these chemical cues. And so what we expect to see is, in colonies that display low levels of aggression, for example, here, towards these two single methyl C35s, these are probably colonies that naturally have C35s in their profile and have that as some of the labels that they naturally use for nest mate recognition. Whereas the opposite is true here. We expect to see that when we go back and look at these natural populations that display high levels of aggression towards, say, this C35, those probably have very low concentrations of this, and it's not a label in their nest mate recognition system. I say this is a huge amount of work. For each of these controls and treatments, we do 50 behavioral assays. So this represents nearly 2,000 behavioral assays, and we've probably almost doubled the amount of behavioral assays we've done so far. And so it's very much a work in progress, but we're pretty excited by the preliminary patterns that we're seeing. We can also take these individuals that we've treated with our synthetic hydrocarbons, and instead of using them in a behavioral assay, re-extract off the hydrocarbons, run those on a GC mass spec, and look at the profiles to make sure that we've manipulated the profile in the way that we think we have. And indeed, that looks like the case. So here's a profile of Argentine ants from our negative control where they've just been treated with hydrocarbons from nest mates. Here are Argentine ants that have been treated with the synthetic C35. You can see just this peak has increased. Here's another case where they've just been treated with the C37, and only this peak has increased. And so it looks like our hydrocarbons are only altering the individual peaks that we're interested in. And so we're really excited about what this could potentially tell us about the label side of nest mate recognition, but we're also really excited about what it can tell us about the other side of nest mate recognition, that is template formation. So you can imagine, for example, there are, first let me step back a little bit. So there are some clear patterns here if we look at these hydrocarbon profiles. So for example, here there are two examples of 5-13-17 trimethyls that are some of our leading candidates for those used in nest mate recognition. They differ only by the length of the hydrocarbon chain. But then there's also a very similar hydrocarbon that's shorter by two carbons, has the same exact methyl group configuration, but it's present at equal concentrations in all Argentine colonies we've looked at. And so we might say, even though that this has an overall structure that looks like some of our candidate hydrocarbons for recognition, we would expect, based on the distribution naturally in Argentine colonies, that this one, despite its similarity structurally to these, should not trigger nest mate interspecific aggression in any Argentine colonies. Similarly, there are hydrocarbons that we can synthesize that don't occur in anybody's hydrocarbon profile at all, that are very similar structurally to some of our leading candidates, and we can hypothesize that maybe these would trigger aggression in everybody. And so we can start to use these synthetic hydrocarbons and patterns that emerge from our candidates to ask questions about what it is structurally about these molecules that's important for recognizing them. Is it the number or placement of the methyl groups? Is it the carbon chain? Or is it a combination of all of these different things? And so these sort of serve for us as a thread that we're going to hope to pull on for a few years to unravel different elements of the recognition system. And so this is the label side of things. We're also interested in template formation. How do individual ants know what labels they're supposed to accept as nest mates versus non-nest mates? And so we're starting up some experiments where we're also using these synthetic hydrocarbons to answer these types of questions, where we can include these synthetic hydrocarbons that Argentine ants might normally display aggression towards. We can include these in the social environment of developing workers and ask, do these workers then imprint on these odors and incorporate these hydrocarbons into their template, and at adulthood, instead of the normal situation, don't display aggression towards them? So by manipulating the social environment or the hydrocarbons that are around as workers are developing their template, can we sort of figure out some of the mechanisms for how these templates form and how they're structured? Also, we know a lot from the Drosophila literature, or we're beginning to learn a lot from the Drosophila literature about how short-term and long-term memories are formed. And although we don't have access to a lot of the genetic tools that Drosophila biologists have, there are a lot of pharmacological tools we can use to sort of block this template formation pathway to try and figure out how do these templates form if we're able to manipulate them in this way. How much more time? That was my last slide. Wasn't expecting that. So with that, I'd just like to thank a number of people who have played central roles in this research, especially Ken Shea and his lab, who have done a lot of heavy lifting in terms of the hydrocarbon synthesis, Miriam Brandt up there in the green, who did a lot of the initial behavioral assays with the hydrocarbon profiles, and Ellen Van Wilgenberg in my lab now, who's continuing this work, hopefully many decades into the future. And I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have.
one really good question.
Only a good one, though.
Yeah.
Also for both, do you have an idea about the isobaric
things
from the trimethyl launch or the dimethyl
launch? Yeah. So that's a great question.
That's imagine you have a mix of
Yeah, that's exactly true. Especially for these trimethyls. So I've actually recently been seeking funding for this research, for those of you out there sitting on the panel. These are not isomerically pure. And so one of the things we're interested in doing in the future is, you know, doing the stereoisomerically pure syntheses of, you know, the eight different trimethyls that actually, you know, have this chemical formula, and testing those individually and in combination. And the same thing is true when you look at these hydrocarbon profiles. You know, we have an individual peak here, which looks like it might be, you know, maybe this the same size peak from colony to colony to colony, but it could be different, you know, there could be different ratios of the isomers that are occurring there. And so that's clearly an important direction to go, but it's, you know, it's technically challenging to do those types of syntheses, and so we're starting with what we can.